How did you picture your own role in the war, in the context of the entire war?
Oh, obviously, I won it single-handedly. Oh, you didn't think about things like that. You did what you had to do. Really, we were not fighting in the same war. The war in the Pacific was totally different from the war in Europe. It was two different wars. They were fought in two different ways. Europe was civilized. They had roads. They had railroads. They had cities. They had manufacturing industries. We were fighting a jungle war, or a war in the Philippines. It wasn't jungle, but it was not too far removed. It was pretty primitive.
Now that we have the recording going, you should tell about the airfields that you were flying out of, how primitive they were. You were telling
The airfields in New Guinea, they would take an area that the first the infantry would recover something from the Japanese. Then they'd go in and the engineers would build a strip, and they could build an airfield, an airstrip, in 5, 6, 7 days. And then fly, get fighters in there, and then expand it to become more or less of a, what you'd call an air depot. And then you'd have bombers there and transports coming in and out. To give you an example, when the Japanese moved into New Guinea, the Australians still held Port Moresby. So their fighters were based in Port Moresby. They had some bombers based there. Also, some bombers still based in Australia who would have to fly up. And they fought out of Port Moresby until they were able to jump over the Owen Stanley mountain range when the Americans landed at Buna. And the Australians pushed over the Owen Stanleys toward Gona. And they pushed the Japanese out. Then the first base on the inland side of the island was a base at a place called Dobadura. And again, it started out as probably an engineered strip. The C-47s were supplying the Australian and American troops by flying supplies in and taking the wounded out. And then they built Dobadura into a pretty good base. And then from Dobadura they started advancing BAMP, the bomber line. And in New Guinea, what you were doing was jumping the bomber line. The bomber line was about 400 miles from your base. Because the bomber line was the area at which the bombers could go with fighter protection. The problem always was that the bombers could outrange the fighters. But bombers unescorted were meat on the table for the Japanese. So they tried to hold the bombers within a range where they could be protected by fighters. To do that, you'd have to jump up and make a landing and then put in another airstrip, and then everything moves up and another 400 miles. So they leapfrogged their way up New Guinea from Port Moresby across the Owen Stanleys to Buna, from Buna up to Nadsab in the Markham Valley. The Nips were still at Lae. From Nadsab to Hollandia, and they bypassed big concentration of Nips at Wewak. From Hollandia up to Biak, which is a little island off the end of New Guinea. If you have a map, you can see these places. I gave it to you. It started, I'm upside down. Where's Port Moresby? Down there somewhere. All right, it started there. Ned's Ebb would have been about there. Then Hollandia's up here somewhere. And Beak is way up here. And that's the way they do it. And every time MacArthur would run a landing, they'd bypass a lot of Japanese and leave them there. And they just left them to die on the vine. The Australians would surround them and keep chewing away at them, and we kept moving up. And we landed at Leyte, and then we went from Leyte to Mindoro. There were still Japanese in Mindanao and Negros and I can't remember the name of the island. Cebu, I think. And there were Japanese on Luzon. We landed at Lingayen Gulf on Luzon, and the army drove down to Manila, and we recovered Clark Field, which had been a big army air base at the beginning of the war. The Nips had caught us on the ground there, and essentially wiped out what few airplanes the Americans had. But we got Clark Field back. But when my group moved into Clark Field, the day that we landed there, and they gave us a camp area where we were to set up our camp and everything. So our cooks got there first, and they'd set up a cook tent, and they were cooking our lunch. And I rode up in the Army 6x6 and saw two or three explosions. Over by the cook tent. I thought, oh my God, they've blown up the gasoline stoves, and there goes our lunch. And we started unloading our gear from the truck, and three more of those explosions came. And I realized, they're shooting at us. They were shelling us, I think, with mortars. So the ground was honeycombed with Japanese foxholes, and American infantry just pushed them up the road about 500 yards or so. And we were within mortar range of those Japanese positions. So somebody got on the phone and called for backup, and American artillery got into the game and silenced the mortars. Yeah. But we stayed in Clark Field for several months, and then we moved to Lingayen Gulf.
And is that where the airfield was on the beach?
Yeah. What had happened at Lingayen Gulf, I think, I'm not sure of this. The airstrip was on the beach, which made it 90 degrees to the prevailing wind. The fighter group that was stationed there had P-47s, Thunderbolts. Thunderbolt was a very good airplane. It weighed 7.5 tons fully loaded. It was a beast. But it had 14 feet between the landing gear, and it was only a 41-foot wingspan. So it had these big wide wheels. And when you put that airplane on the ground, it stayed there. But they started converting them to P-51s. And I think they cracked up 7 P-51s in a week, trying to switch over from the one to the other. P-51 was not a good airplane to train on to learn how to fly when you had a 90-degree crosswind. So we swapped. The P-51 group came in and took over our base at Clark Field, and we went up to Lingayen and took their base. Trouble was, we had built our base up. We had floors in our tents, and we had electric lights, and we had an officer's club with a bar. We were living it up. We got up to Lingayen Gulf. We had nothing but sand. And their tents didn't even have floors in them or anything like that. So we took about 2 weeks off to build ourselves a reasonably comfortable camp. And then we flew from there.
Where were you when the war ended?
Trying to remember. I think I was still at Lingayen Gulf. My squadron had moved up to Aoshima, which is a little island off the coast of Okinawa. But I hadn't gone up with them yet. I was still there with a rear echelon. The way you did it, when you made a move, you'd send up an advance echelon. They would set up the rudiment camp, food supply, latrines, and so forth. Then the main body would move by water. And then the rear echelon would fly up after everything was up and running. And I flew a P-38 up there. But I was on the verge of going home at this point. And they actually had sent me to Clark Field. I'd taken my nice new airplane and turned it over to a replacement group at Clark. And I was expecting to get orders to go to Manila and go home. But I didn't get any orders. So I went back to my outfit and moved on up, and I ended up in Korea. And when the war ended, we were sent up to Korea for occupation duty. That's when I finally got my orders to go home. But they said I was supposed to leave from Manila. And I'm up in Seoul. And I was very glad to get out of there because we had summer uniforms. And it gets cold in Korea, starting about the middle of October. So I got a guy from one of the other squadrons who was going over to Tokyo, and he found my orders and brought them back, and now I had the paper that I needed. The only trouble was I was 1,000 miles away from where I was supposed to be, so I had to hitchhike. And I hitchhiked from Korea to Kyushu, from Kyushu to Okinawa, from Okinawa down to Manila, and finally I ended up in the place in Manila I was supposed to be, and then I got on a Navy transport and took off for San Francisco. Took us 17 days to get from Manila to San Francisco, and then another 6 days on day coaches to ride across the country to Fort Dix. And I got home 2 days before Christmas. That was interesting.
Well, how many, you mentioned that one of your colleagues had gone home while you were in, where you were still in flying. How many missions did you have to fly before you were eligible to go back home?
Didn't work that way.
How did it work?
Generally speaking, in Europe, it did work that way. In the beginning, 25 missions, they rotated you out. Later on, as we began to get more power, it went up to 35 missions. In the Pacific, usually they would send you home when they decided that you were suffering from combat fatigue.
Oh.
You'd flown too many. And you'd survived, and so they'd send you home. Now, in the early days, they didn't. They sent you down to Australia to rest, and then you came back. But by the time I got into it, they'd send you out on combat fatigue. So my orders to go home, when they finally caught up with me, said I was going home on combat fatigue. But by that time, the war was over, and I was hitchhiking around the Western Pacific pretty much on my own. I wasn't AWOL because I was still with my group, but I was not counted on the roster or anything like that. When I got up to Seoul, I had a ball. I'd get a jeep and go into town. I had a Korean girlfriend for about 2 weeks. And then I decided I better get out of there. because of the weather. So somebody gave me a, found a copy of my orders, and I hitchhiked to, from Seoul to Kyushu, down to Okinawa, then to Manila, and then I got into the place where I was supposed to have been for the last 2 months. And from then I got there, I got home.
What went through your mind around then, when the war was over?
Well, we were obviously glad the war was over. But, you know, it was a strange feeling. I'd been in the Army for 3 years. I'd been overseas for over a year. And then the war ended. And all of a sudden, you felt as if you had no purpose in life. Everything suddenly became meaningless. You didn't have anything to do anymore. You didn't have any missions to fly. You were just, I can't describe it. It was like being cut off from reality until finally you get your act together and start maneuvering to get out of there and get back. But at first it was a feeling of emptiness. Peace is too quiet. Really.
How did you readjust to regular civilian life?
As far as I was concerned, I didn't have a problem, but I'm not so sure that my parents felt that way about me. One of the things that in fighter command, whenever you got you flew a combat mission, you got a 2-ounce shot of 100-proof bourbon when you landed. But that wasn't the way we worked it. Our crew chiefs would greet us when we got out of our airplanes, hand us a canteen cup full of something. Here, Lieutenant, drink this. It was jungle juice or God only knows. Filipino whiskey, which essentially was rum. It was sugarcane alcohol. And the bourbon we would save until we got a full quart. And then we'd have a binge drinking. But drinking and flying were two things that went together. So by the time I got home, I wasn't an alcoholic, but I sure could put away a lot of booze, and did. So my mother was a school teacher, and said, I went home to Pelham, and she came home one day for lunch. And she had two or three of her teachers along with her. They were going to have lunch, and I was sitting in the living room with 10 ounces of scotch about 11:45 in the morning. And she walked in and saw that wide-eyed, didn't realize that this was what we were used to doing. And it took a while to wind that down, I guess. I used to keep a fifth under my bed. First thing I did when I woke up in the morning was take a belt. But
different lifestyle.
Well, you know, when you're a combat pilot, you live at a very up-tempo pace. You don't worry about what's going to happen next week or next month. You live from day to day, pretty much. You don't worry, but you don't plan ahead either. Mm. And in the meantime, you live it up.
Right.
Wine, women, and song, you know. That's what we used to call our silver wings, our little persuaders.
Yeah.
Buy them by the dozen.
How were you received by friends and family when you made it home?
Well, family was glad to see me. Friends, several of them were killed. Others had gone to different places in the world. I was pretty much on my own when I first got home. I really didn't know very many people of the group that I'd been with. Girls had gotten married, guys had been killed or had moved away. I went back to Yale. And I flew reserve for a while. I'd put on a uniform on Saturday and take the train down from New Haven to Pelham, borrow my father's car, drive up to Newburgh, fly in the reserve. We had 1811s and AT-6s. And then after I got a few hours in, I'd go back, take a train back to New Haven, and go back to being a college student. And that went on for, I don't know, 2-3 months. To the end of the, probably to the end of the term. And the following year, I stopped the flying.
When did you graduate?
I graduated in June of 1948. My class was 1945 W. W stood for war. But when I got back, they gave me a term's credit for military service. So that backed me up from the class of 1948 to what they called the class of 1947 M. They had accelerated all of these classes during the war. So they had 47M and 47N. And I got out. Then they were decelerating. So 47M, which should have graduated in March, now graduated in June. But I had a year in before the war and 2.5 years afterwards.
Did quite a few of your classmates enlist when you enlisted? It seemed like there were a lot of Yale students.
Oh, yeah. I think in my class, my freshman class, I think there are a little over 1,000 of us, 1,020 and 25, something like that. And almost all of them went into the service, one branch or another. Mm-hmm. A lot of them went into the Navy. Oh. They got into the V-12 program or V-7 or whatever they called it because they were able to stay on a while longer. And they got commissioned ensigns. And then a lot of them came back as Lieutenant JGs. I volunteered for the Army Air Corps. And they let me finish my freshman year. And then I was called active duty right after the first of the year. And so I left and started off at Atlantic City in basic training as a private in the Army. But I was designated to go into cadet training and then moved up from there. Graduated from cadets in March of 1944 and was commissioned a second lieutenant and rated as an Army pilot. And then I went through P-40 and P-47 training, P-40 transition, P-47 training. And I was in New Guinea by September 1st. And then I spent the rest of the time overseas till the war ended.
Have you been involved in any veterans organizations?
Nah. I was a reserve officer for a while, but veterans organizations are for non-combat types, I think, for the most part. I shouldn't really say that, but a lot of these office commandos, as we used to call them.
Yeah, one other question for you. What What did you think of MacArthur? Were you a fan of his?
Nobody really was a fan of his. He had a very big ego. And he was surrounded by staff officers who licked his boots for him, I'm sure. We didn't know MacArthur, but his reputation wasn't too good with most of us.
Oh, really?
But undeservedly, he was a very good general. No question about that.
And he was in charge of the Army Air Corps, your group.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was the
commander. Well, Kenny was our our general, but Kenny reported to MacArthur.
Okay.
MacArthur was the supreme commander for the Southwest Pacific.
Right.
And Kenny was the general in command of the 5th Air Force, and then later on the 5th and 13th. And they became thief Far East Air Forces.
And who was Hap Arnold in charge of them?
Well, Hap Arnold was the commanding general for the whole Air Force.
Oh, I see.
The whole Army Air Corps.
Okay.
He was in Washington.
Okay.
And he never left Washington.
Mm. How would you reflect on how your war experiences have affected your whole life?
Well, I'll tell you, when I went back to Yale, I was a sophomore. My brother was entering as a freshman. He's 4 years younger than I am. And I used to say that the difference between us was I was 20 going on 40, and he was 18 going on 19. Mm. That was the difference. I mean, before the war, at college, it was almost parietal. Everybody looked up to the faculty. You wore coats and ties to class. You were polite. When we got back, the difference between the returning vets and the kids that were just coming out of high school or prep school, it was a difference of night and day. I mean, some instructor might be telling you something about something that was going on, and some GI would stand up and say, "That's a lot of bullshit. I was there and I know."
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And whereas the kids would never have done anything like that. They wouldn't dare talk back to a member of the faculty. But those of us who had been there and done that knew. And we were not particularly reverent.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a bit of difference. But the thing that I think was probably most noticeable was the difference between returning combat veterans who'd been on their own for 3 years or so, and had some of them survived under rather harrowing circumstances, and the kids who'd been living at home with Mama and Papa and were still pretty much under the parental wing. It was night and day. My brother used to ask me, he asked me some years later, why, when we were both at Yale at the same time, I had nothing to do with him. And the truth of the matter was, he was a nice kid. I didn't want him running around with people like me and the ones that I traveled with.
Mm.
We were hellraisers.
Mm.
You had to see the difference. But I never told him that at the time. I just made sure that he wasn't around when wherever we were.
Right.
He was nice and polite, well-behaved, and he didn't keep a bottle under his bed and take it pop for a sick in the morning.
And I think the last question on my end, at least, what kinds of life lessons do you think you got out of the war? I know that might be kind of a cheesy question.
Life lessons?
Yeah.
Oh, I think probably the thing that you get out of it is you grow up very fast. You become self-sufficient very fast. You understand how to survive very fast. You're exposed to things that most people are never exposed to. But you learn to make decisions and to take actions. Whereas if you'd gone through the normal routine of growing up and going to college, you wouldn't do that. And it made a large difference in the way I lived. I got a job as a salesman. I met Elena on Sunday night, married her Monday morning. Now, the average person doesn't do that. Mm-hmm. She traveled with me. That moved me up into, they moved me up into management jobs. I quit and went into management consulting. And I think I probably was the youngest associate that they'd ever hired at Robert Heller & Associates. I was only 29 or 28. And normally they were in their middle 30s. And they didn't know what to make of me at first. But by the time I was in my mid-30s, I was on a first-name basis with the presidents of two of the leading railroads in the United States, the Postmaster General of the United States, the deputy, his deputy, and the Assistant Postmaster General for Operations. I was 34, 35 years old. Just didn't happen for the most part with kids who come out of school. No matter how smart they were, there was a difference. And when I went to work for Bob Heller, one year, I'd been with him for a while, he asked me how old I was. And I told him, he said, "My God," he said, "I thought you were my age."
Oh, my gosh.
It was an interesting coming back and readjusting to normal life. We weren't normal. We really weren't. Now, I don't know whether it was the same with the people that came from Europe, because they lived under civilized circumstances, but we were survivalists. And we took chances that ordinary people don't take. And we made decisions that way. And my mother and father were horrified when I called them up. I sent them a telegram. I said, "I married Elena Garcia this morning." My mother said, "Who is she, you know?" You didn't do things like that. But
okay. Well, I think that's all. Do you have anything else in there?
No. I think you answered all of my questions. I asked all of my questions.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Really interesting.
It's been an interesting life.